Today's Taisho will be on case 40 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 40 is entitled Tipping Over a Water Bottle. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai-i, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took the water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakujo then asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakujo laughs and said, "The head monk loses," and Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment, Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakujo's apron strings. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband to put on an iron yoke. Mumon's verse, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come from the tips of his feet. So this is a famous contest. Basically, Hyakujo, in Chinese Baijiang, was the master, and Isan Osho just means priest. So Isan, priest Osho, was with Hyakujo, and he was the tenzo, the cook. And in the poem, it says, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made his glorious dash and swept all before him. See, those are the cooking instruments. So we could say in English, pots and pans. Tossing his pots and pans away, he made a dash for greatness, see. So, actually, In the Zen koans, there are a number of contests like this, right? You know, so there was a very famous contest that involved the fifth Dharma ancestor and Wei Neng and Shen Xiu. And basically, it was like this: the fifth Dharma ancestor knew his days were numbered, and he wanted to pick a worthy successor. So he asked all the monks in the monastery to compose a poem that would show their state of awakening. This is according to Zen legend and also one of the koans. So in the story, the fifth Dharma ancestor asked all the monks to compose a poem that would reflect their or exhibit their level of attainment. And Shen Xiu was the head monk. So when the fifth ancestor asked all the monks to compose a poem showing their enlightenment, actually, none of the other monks composed a poem. They all knew that Shen Xiu was the best. So Shen Xiu composed a poem that went like this, you know, something like this. The mind is like a mirror, and it collects dust, and you have to do your zazen practice to clean the surface of the mirror of dust, see. And all the monks in the monastery could read this poem, which was displayed on a pillar in the Dharma hall. And when they read it, they all went, oh, yep, Shensye, he understands the Dharma, see. But it turns out that in the kitchen, there was he wasn't even a monk, he was just a hired hand, and his name was Wei Neng. And Wei Neng was working in the kitchen husking rice. So we eat brown rice, but they didn't want to eat brown rice, they wanted to eat nice huskless rice. So he would pound the rice to get the husks off so that it could be nice and white. And most people in East Asia used to like white rice, not brown rice. So Wei Neng had been hired to work as a kitchen help because he was an illiterate woodcutter, and nobody thought anything of him. But actually, Wei Neng was deeply awake, according to the story. And he couldn't write, but he asked somebody in the kitchen, one of the monks, he said, I hear that the fifth Dharma ancestor is holding a contest to see who will be the next leader of our community. And Shensye has written a poem, and I would like to write a poem. And so when the monk cook heard this helper, this hired hand, Wei Neng, ask for a pencil and paper, he gave it to them, and then he took dictation. And he wrote down Wei Neng's poem. And he thought, I'll humor this guy, right? Basically, I'll humor this guy. He's an illiterate woodcutter. What does he know? Anyway, he wrote Wei Neng's poem down. And the poem was, there is no mirror and there is no dust. From the beginning, not a thing is. So anyway, to humor Wei Neng, the cook monk put it out in the Dharma hall next to Shensye's poem. They didn't have scotch tape in those days, but they attached it somehow. So anyway, the fifth Dharma ancestor came out of his room to survey the entries. And he read Shensye's poem about cleaning the mirror from the dust from the mirror. And he nodded like, yes, that's very sensible. And then he read Wei Neng's poem. And he didn't say anything. He just went back into his room. And then later that night, he asked Wei Neng, he had one of his monks go and find Wei Neng in the hired hand's bunkhouse. And Wei Neng came in and he said, you are my Dharma heir. You are deeply awake. You see farther than Shensye. And so I am appointing you my Dharma heir. Here is my robe, and here is my begging bowl. Now get out of here, because these monks are going to be mad at you. They'll beat you up, because they have been working with me for 20 years, and you just walked in, and I'm giving you this prestigious acknowledgement. So anyway, Wei Neng left, and he is supposed to have become the founder of our Zen tradition. These are both stories about competition. And they both are stories about competition that involves a cook, a humble cook, right? And in fact, Wei Neng's not even a humble cook. He's an assistant to the humble cook. And in both of these stories, the person who is sort of like down the totem pole beats the person who is at the top of the totem pole. And we all like this kind of a story, right? I mean, basically, I'm a sucker for this myself, right? I have seen a number of movies that are about, I hate to tell you this, you might think less of me, but one of my favorite movies in the world is The Karate Kid. And so it's a totally unsophisticated view of reality and everything else. But I actually love that movie, right? You know? So I've probably seen it 100 times, you know. So anyway, the Karate Kid, you know, Daniel-san getting beaten up, you know, and this obscure Japanese martial arts master is, you know, working in and running an apartment complex and cutting his bonsai trees, and Daniel-san runs into him, and he turns Daniel-san into this, and at, you know, the end of the movie, if you know that movie, it's like everybody's lifting Daniel-san up on, you know, on their shoulders, and he's got his trophy in his hand, and he looks over, he says, "Thank you, Mr. Miyagi," and we get Pat Morita's wonderful, I love Pat Morita as an actor, and we have his wonderful smile, right, you know. And the music, da da da. So, you know, triumph. The little guy triumphs. You know how great that is, and it is great. You know, it is great. You know, the idea that that Wei Nang, this illiterate woodcutter, would beat out this very well educated Mandarin Shansu. You know, that's so satisfying, right? I'm an English teacher, and you know, there's a running battle about whether Shakespeare could have written the plays we call Shakespeare's plays, because we know that he was just an ordinary sort of middle class kid who got a public school education, and he wrote these brilliant plays, and there are lots of snobs who say there's no way this dolt could have written these brilliant plays, and they find some aristocrat who they claim wrote the plays, and then there's the defenders of Shakespeare who say, well, he's a perfectly intelligent person, he could have written these plays, you know, I went to public school myself, you know, so. So, and I'm definitely on that side, having gone to public school. And there's a joke, which is probably an English professor's joke, but making fun of the people who say Shakespeare didn't write the plays, somebody wrote an article that said Shakespeare did not write the plays; they were written by another man named Shakespeare. You know, so. Anyway, that's English professors. written by some other man with the same name, right? That was the idea. So anyway, we love that, right? It's nice to, we all feel in our lives pretty squashed, right? That's definitely something that happens to most of us when we're growing up. You know, we all feel, one of the reasons, people like, I think, you know, these movies about a Rocky, Karate Kid, there's so many of these movies. Even Harry Potter, right? I mean, Harry Potter is living under the stairs of this house. He's an adopted kid who's treated poorly by his adoptive parents, and he's shoved around, and lo and behold, he turns out to be the special one, right? And his adoptive family turns out to be, they're just a bunch of muggles, right? You know, so probably we've all had fantasies like that, you know. We've all had that experience of being squashed or pushed around. And our culture is relentlessly competitive, right? It's relentlessly competitive. So, you know, everything turns into a competition. Now in the state of New Jersey, when you're in the second grade, this might have happened to you, I don't know, but when you're in the second grade, you have to take a standardized test. And it's like, I can't believe it, right? So second graders take a standardized test, and they can be held back because they didn't, you know. When I was in the second grade, I was thinking about my Zorro lunchbox, you know. I wasn't worried about being held back, you know. I think in the second grade, I had to do things with finger paints, you know, and that was the highlight of the day, and cutting out colored construction paper to make autumn leaves. And if I could get, you know, 2 plus 2, you know, my 2 plus 2s and so on, I was doing fine, you know. If not too many of my letters were backwards, excellent. So, you know, basically, it was a different world. It was a different world, you know. And now kids have to take this test. And then there's a high school exit test. Then you take the SAT or the ACT. You know, if you want to go to graduate school, you have to take, you know, if you want to go to medical school, it's the MCAT. If you want to go to law school, it's the LSAT. You know, there's a dental test, you know. And every time you turn around, there's, you know, you're in a competitive situation. And so, you know, this koan is a very appealing koan in a certain way, you know. We all want to identify with the little guy who makes it big, you know, who succeeds. So in this case, the head monk, Hyakucho says, here's a bottle. I'm going to put it on the ground, and I want you to say something Zen about it or respond to it in a Zen way. And you can't call it a bottle. In other words, you know, I want you to exhibit your understanding of fundamental reality. How do you interact with the world? And the head monk says, it's not a stump. So he says, I won't call it a bottle, I'll say it's not a stump, or I could say it's not an automobile, right? But Isan's response is so much better, because he acts spontaneously from his big mind, see? So the koan has like two different aspects to it. One is this competitive aspect and the little guy getting it over on the big guy, right? So, you know, finally the cook is getting his due. You know, so the guy at the back of the line goes to the front of the line. The guy at the front of the line is now laughed at by his teacher in public, you know. So the teacher says, you dope, you know. Put your ladles away, your pots and pans, you're headed for the top, see. So there's that dimension to the koan. And then there's this other dimension, which is rather different. And that is, you know, we need to cultivate Zen spontaneity. Zen spontaneity. And so when you come into Dokusan, when you come into the Dokusan room, you know, I'm asking you to demonstrate Zen spontaneity, see? And this is very difficult to do, you know, because we don't trust. We don't trust the big mind, see? When people go into the Dokusan room and the teacher, I mean, I can remember, you know, listening in the line outside the Dokusan room and hearing people call Mu. And, you know, it would just sound like a freight train. You know, some of these people would go in there and it sounded like a freight train was going through. It's like, wow. You know, and I would go in there and I couldn't even open my mouth. I became so blocked, right? I mean, when I was working on the Mu koan, I was waiting to have this inner energy to call Mu. And I would just go into this blankness and when I would go into the Dokusan room and Genki Roshi would say, okay, please call Mu, my heart would just sink. You know, it's like, and he would even sort of go, come on, you know, give it a try, you know. And I just say, I can't do it, I can't do it. You know, it's a ding out of the room. And I can remember one session in particular where I had arrived late to the session. It had just started, and I had just come from my apartment in Seattle. We were having the session at a rented place that was fairly far away. And when I got there and unpacked my stuff, I realized that I had forgotten my sitting pants. And so I had to do the whole session in my blue jeans. If you've ever had to try to sit in blue jeans, it's torture, you know. So I was too far. I was like on this Bainbridge Island, and I was quite far from like a store. So, first of all, the sesshin was just like a torture chamber, sitting in my blue jeans. But at the very end of the sesshin, you know, everybody was going moo, and Genki Roshi used to laugh. He'd say, "Don't even bother to show me your moo if you can't knock somebody over with it," you know, which would just make me feel like I'll never accomplish this, right? So anyway, I was incapable at the time of Zen spontaneity, right? And cultivating Zen spontaneity is a complicated matter. It takes a lot of practice before we learn to trust, right? Before we learn to trust. You have to do a lot of sitting in blank mind or a lot of koan work before you are in a place where you trust. You know, one of the problems with koan training is people just don't believe it. You know, all the answers to every koan, you have at your disposal. You have at your disposal. It's right there. You just have to sit in the blankness and your big mind will produce the answer for you. I trained even with people, you know, who would get a koan and then they would go and research the koan, right? So I remember I had to do this koan too, but at this time, one of my friends was working on a koan. It goes, Manjushri rides the lion, Samantabhadra rides the elephant. What does the Buddha ride? See? And I remember my friend, he went to like the library, the Asian library at the University of Washington, and he researched some, you know, not trusting, right? It was like there's got to be an answer in one of these books, right? And so we've trusted our intuition in the past, and it hasn't paid off for us sometime, or we think it hasn't paid off, right? I definitely know people who have made life decisions that they thought were going to turn out differently. You know, so people who, you know, basically quit their job to write the great American novel, and then, you know, halfway through the process, they realize they either realize I'm not a novelist, or they realize this is a terrible novel, right? So we've all had those kinds of, where you sort of trust yourself a little bit and then you sort of get burned. So cultivating Zen spontaneity is not easy because we've had these negative experiences. But, you know, when you're working with the koan, and in particular when you're working with the mu koan, you're learning how to have, like, you could say, educated intuition, or, you know, trusting your big self in the proper way, trusting your big mind in the proper way. You know, so when you're sitting on the cushion and you're in blank mind, you know, you're as I mentioned yesterday, you know, you can't rely on your existing knowledge. You can't rely on what you already know, because that won't show you anything new. You know, if you're caught in your own mental loops, or you're caught in your own assumptions, you can't think your way out of it. So you need to go to that blankness. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the blank mind is like a door into your big mind. When you are following the breath, you're breathing out, and you look at the screen in your mind, and it's blank, you know, that's the ideal situation. And you just keep returning to that blankness, and you're actually going up to the door to your unconscious, and you're sort of knocking on the door. And you're waiting for that door to open, you know. Now, the thing is, discriminating mind, your small mind, is sitting there thinking nothing is happening, Nothing. This is a failure. Nothing is happening. I'm not getting anywhere. This will happen to you, by the way, if you continue to do Zen. This will happen to you for years and years until you stop listening to that voice. But the teacher will give you a koan, and you'll sit, you'll go back to the cushion, and you'll think, oh man, I'm never going to solve this, right? And you'll be sitting with it maybe for a couple sessions, or maybe for a year. And the whole time your discriminating mind is saying, nothing's happening. This is a waste of time. I'm a failure, etc. And then suddenly you walk in and say something to the teacher, and the teacher says, oh, that's a wonderful answer. So all the processing is happening on the unconscious level. Lots of things are changing about the way you experience the world, but you'll, in a way, your conscious mind is the last to know the news. So when you're doing Zen practice, if you're looking at your situation from the small mind standpoint, it will always seem like nothing is happening. But trust the big mind. And when you're working with the Mukon, this is like the perfect situation. Because there's nothing for your small mind to grasp. And it's probably going to be saying things like, I'm going to fail. I'm not going to be successful. Nothing is happening. I'm getting nowhere. Why did I come here? You know. But please trust that something is happening under the surface. One of the things that can happen, although it doesn't always happen, is that you may begin to build up a lot of energy. So when you're facing the blankness and you're calling Mu, you know, you may begin to notice that you, for a long time, when you do that, it may just feel like nothing is happening. You may feel calm and serene, or you may feel flat and a little bit affectless, sort of dead. Some people experience the initial stages of Zen practice as like a kind of deadness. There's a Zen teacher named Albert Low who said he felt like he was sitting in the cold and the dark for 2 years. So that's how he experienced that period where he was just knocking on the door of his big mind and nothing was happening. Other people experience, I had a much more positive experience. I just felt it was serene, but that was it, you know. But eventually what happens in many cases, though not all cases, is that, you know, you begin to build up energy. So it may feel at first like tension, but eventually it just builds up in energy. It can be annoying. It can actually be like annoying. You know, because you want to be in that serene, calm place, but actually it's like you feel pressure building up, let's say, in your forehead. And it seems to be like, well, something's wrong, you know. But actually, you may even feel like you want to jump out of your skin sometimes. But actually, you know, building up that pressure is part, it can be part of the process of working with the Mu Koan. And it will. This may actually happen to you again with later koans, you know. You know, people are undergoing a very significant change on a deeper level, which isn't visible to the conscious mind. But I remember being in a doka. We used to form a dokusan line rather than going directly from the zendo into dokusan. We used to leave the zendo, sit in a dokusan line, and then go in to see the teacher that way. And I remember sitting in a dokusan line and looking at the person in front of me, and it just seemed like the hair on his head was standing up straight, you know. I think he was in such a state of total activation, you know, total activation. And then he went in and called Mu, and he was in there for a long time. And then I went in and called Mu, and I was in there for a minute. You know. but you know, this building up of pressure is not an accident or problem. If it happens to you, it's part of the process of break of that wall or that door between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind opening up. You know, so for a long time, when you come into the Dokusan room and you call Mu, it may feel very labored and even humiliating, right? I mean, how silly to go in there. And somebody actually said, mentioned that this is what cows do. When he came into Dokusan, he said, "Does anybody has anybody mentioned that this sounds like a cow?" He was actually a little cleverer than I have just been, but he made a good joke about it. But actually, I have noticed that, you know. In our Zendo, we built a temple in the mountains outside of Seattle that was right next to public forest. And in the West, you know, they rent public land out to ranchers and let them graze their cattle. And we didn't have fences up around our land, so the cattle would come right onto our land, and they'd be, and we were all sitting in the Zendo. At this time, we were still building the Zendo, so we had our summer sesshin, and there were no windows. There were no mosquitoes, so we didn't have a problem, but there were no windows. So we're sitting in this windowless Zendo, and we're all sitting there. It's early in the morning, and we're all saying, "Moo, moo," and then the cows come up. And they start going, "Ooh, ooh." And when that happened, everybody burst into laughter, you know. So yes, it has occurred to me. And then Genki Roshi said something. He said, "The difference between the cow's moo and your moo is that the cow isn't self-conscious. You know, it's just totally trusting big mind." So it's hard to learn to trust. And when you are going through this process of calling Mu, it can often be the case that this energy builds up, and let it build up. You know, let it build up. I was stuck with the Mu koan for, you know, my teacher Genki Roshi was a very kind of strict, traditional Japanese Zen master. And you know, if it took you 4 years or 5 years to answer your koan, no problem. You know, no problem. So I was doing Mu koan for the longest time. When you're working on any koan, you're going to build up this energy, you know. And then part of the koan is building up this energy, and then part of the koan is just letting go and trusting. It's like drawing a bow and firing an arrow. You know, you pull the bow back. You pull your, in Japanese, this is called ki and kyo. So when you pull, you draw the string of your bow, right, that's ki. You're building up energy, and then you're going to release that energy. And when you're doing your Mu koan, it's the same thing. You know, you're building up energy, and then you have to just let the arrow go. And calling Mu is a way of just letting the arrow go. You know, you're going to build up the energy, and you're going to go into the Dokusan room, and you can't control it. You know, I can remember trying to make my Mu like a freight train, and I would wind up getting so hoarse I could barely get it out. You know, it would just be halfway through, my voice would crack and it would fall apart. You know, you just have to trust the process. It's drawing the bow and then letting the arrow fly. See, and that's what makes this koan so interesting. You know, this koan is such a trap in a way. All koans have a kind of trap or contradiction, you know. They want you to misunderstand so that you can correct your perception. So this koan is encouraging us to be competitive about our experience. But actually, you know, that monk Isan never would have answered the koan the way he did if he were trying to beat the head monk. If his concern was to become head of the temple, he couldn't have had that spontaneity. See, competitiveness doesn't allow us, in my opinion, or I could say in the opinion of the author of this koan, doesn't allow us to reach our full potential. It prevents us from reaching our full potential. You know, what the desire to win, the desire to be excellent, the desire to be perfect, the desire to be, you know, to be carried out by the crowd with the trophy in your hand is a natural human desire. We all want that to happen, right? But nevertheless, you know, that desire traps us. It doesn't allow us to be spontaneous. You know, maybe you're not Daniel-san. Maybe you're somebody else, right? You know, so you might, you know, in the process of, if you're exploring events as they unfold in an open-hearted way, gathering the natural energy of things as they move forward, you have the universe. You're like a ship with a wind at your back. You have the universe at your back. When you're trying to pursue a goal that you already hold in your mind and you're demanding that result, you're sailing into the headwinds that push you back at every step, see? So the way of Zen is to harmonize ourselves with this energy that's arising from deep within us and let that do the leading. Let that be the master, see? You could say, get out of your own way. If your goal is to answer the koan, you will never answer the koan. You won't. If your goal is to be the best Zen student in the room, you'll never be the best. You know, in other words, there is no best. There's your natural unfolding. Harmonize yourself with the Tao. Harmonize yourself with the natural unfold. If the energy is arising, you're doing something right. Right? If you're feeling serene and compassionate, you're doing something right. See, trust yourself, you know. Trust yourself. If you're feeling release, compassion, kindness, groundedness, something's going right for you. Now, you might have a mental image of a very different... This happens all the time with koans. You know, people start with a koan, and, you know, they might think this is the answer, and then the koan takes them in a totally different direction. And sometimes they're fighting the whole way. You know, follow that natural unfolding of energy and see where it leads you. Don't try to be the boss. Don't try to be the winner. See? So this koan is like brilliant because it says, be the winner, try to be the winner, try to be the winner. You know, you want to be like Isan, right? But actually, Isan wasn't like that. He was happy being a cook. He was happy being a cook. See, and maybe he was never as happy again being leading this temple. You know, or maybe he led the temple and he went back to cooking. You know, but the point is, this koan is setting us up to think there's a winner and a loser. And that's the wrong, you know, that's the wrong way to practice Zen. Allowing the energy to lead you, allowing the big mind to lead you, and just, I'll see where it's going, you know. I mean, if you're in a, when I was young, I got very much into archery. In the old kind of archery, where I just used a wooden bow, a composite wooden bow. Now the bows are very high-tech instruments, and I think it's taken all the fun out of it. They're just machines, very predictable for modern Americans to pick that kind of a device or develop that kind of a device. But the old bow is just made with a composite of a couple different kinds of wood. And there's a high degree of uncontrollability about it, you know. And, when you draw the bow, you have to have a certain amount of ki, you know, a certain amount of energy, and then you let it go. But you can't really entirely control where the arrow is going to go. And if you say to yourself, I'm going to hit the bullseye, my experience is it's very difficult to hit the bullseye. You have to have a much more relaxed attitude towards it in order to be quite good at archery. And in life, really, it's like the best way to live is to fire the arrow, and then wherever the arrow lands, go over and paint the target around it. See, that's a bullseye every time. But really, that's the best way to live, because the arrow, you know, the energy is wiser than we are. You know, so you might say, I want to be the great American novelist, right? But in the process, you might become a really good English teacher. Or, you know, and you might really find out that this is really where you belong. You know, there was a very famous anthropologist, he died recently, named Clifford Geertz, or Geertz. And he was interviewed, and they said, what got you into anthropology? And he said, I tried to write a novel, and I failed. And then I couldn't think of what to do, so I went to graduate school. You know? And then he became really the greatest anthropologist of his generation. And he wasn't trying to be. He didn't say, I'm going to be the greatest anthropologist of my generation. He felt disappointed because he didn't write the great American novel. And he began to ask questions about, life in Indonesia. And he didn't know where he was going or what he was doing, and he wrote this book that everybody loves. So living that way, I think, is a superior way to live. You know, it's not competitive. It's not goal-directed. You know, if you could say, in 40 years I'll be doing this, to me that sounds somewhat boring, right? You know, I would rather in 40 years, when I'm 102, I don't know what I'm going to be doing. If I'm around, you know, hopefully I will have picked up some new interests, you know. Getting your dreams, your so-called imagined dreams, it's not necessarily the best thing. Life is actually bigger and richer than your expectations. And koan practice is the same way. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Taiyi, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, you may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it? The head monk said, it cannot be called a stump. Hyakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakujo laughed and said, the head monk loses. And Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment, Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakujo's apron strings. In other words, he's paying him a compliment. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. In other words, he became the head of this temple, which was probably hard work, when he really wanted to be a cook. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband to bear an iron yoke. So a headband used to help you hold up a basket. You would have a basket on your back, like a backpack, and there'd be a strap around your forehead to help you pull the basket. So a cook might take such a rig out shopping for vegetables. But he said he took off his basket and he put on an iron yoke, meaning becoming the head of this monastery. Mumon's verse, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet. Well, yes, only if you have to try and then let go. Only if you try and then let go